Story is told of a very wealthy man who once invited a lot of friends and guests to a large banquet that he was going to have. He had a splendiferous house of sorts, and had a huge hall where he was going to give the feast. And the people came in the multitudes, and he had a extremely long table, and he had chairs on each side, both sides filled, but he only had one chair, his chair, the regal chair, the royal chair, at one end of the table, and the other end of the table had no chair. And so he stayed out of the room and let everybody mingle together, and then it was announced that he was getting ready to come in and the feast was going to begin. And so everybody seated themselves. There were no assigned seats. They seated themselves according to their own estimation of their worth. And moments later, when everybody's gotten in their seat, he comes in and he has them to move his chair from the head of the table down to the other end of the table. Kind of reminiscent of what Jesus said in Luke chapter 14. Starting in verse 7, he told a parable to those who were invited when he noted how they chose the best places, saying to them, "When you are invited by anyone to a wedding feast, do not sit in the best place, lest one more honorable than you be invited by him. And he who invited you and him, come and say to you, 'Give place to this man,' and then you begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you are invited, go and sit down in the lowest place, so that when he who invited you comes, he may say to you, 'Friend, go up higher.' Then you will have glory in the presence of those who sit at the table with you. For whoever exalts himself will be abased. He who humbles himself will be exalted." We're going to talk this evening about pride, but being in a jocular mood, rather than just title my lesson "Pride," when you see the title of the lesson, don't try to find a place in the lesson where that kind of fits. I fell into temptation and decided to call it "Too Proud to Beg." If anybody likes 60s or 70s music, you can share with somebody else what that means. But nonetheless, a man by the name of Thomas Adam once said, "Pride thrust Nebuchadnezzar out of men's society, thrust Saul out of his kingdom, Adam out of paradise, Haman out of court, and Satan out of heaven." Augustine named pride as the greatest of all sins, pointing out that when man is proud, he exalts himself and displaces God. Defoe spoke of pride as the first peer and president of hell. Alexander Pope said that pride was the never-failing vice of fools. C.S. Lewis called pride the complete anti-God state of mind. Proverbs 21 and verse 4 says, "A haughty look, a proud heart, and the plowing of the wicked are sin." Proverbs 16 verse 5 said, "Everyone who is proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord." Pride is commonly used in two senses. In the good sense, pride is synonymous with self-respect, personal dignity, or self-esteem. Self-respect is necessary to one's emotional stability. Self-respect or pride is necessary in order to have the courage to stand for what it is that we believe. It's necessary in order to have conviction about our beliefs and to hold to one's integrity. And so in this sense, pride is essential. But in the bad sense, pride is synonymous with vanity, arrogance, haughtiness, disdain. Webster defines this as inordinate or excessive self-esteem, conceit. And it's this pride that we will consider this evening. As used in the latter sense, pride is sin. Of the seven sins listed in Proverbs 6, verses 16 and 17, pride is one of the things that we're told that God hates. The proverb writer says, "These six things the Lord hates, yes, seven are an abomination to him: a proud look, a lying tongue," and then he lists the others. Pride is a sin that comes from the heart, and Jesus tells us that it defiles a man. In Mark chapter 7, verses 21 through 23, Jesus said, "For from without, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, foolishness, pride. All these things come from within and defile a man." We're told that the pride of life is one of the channels through which Satan tempts man to sin. 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17, "Do not love the world or the things of the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. All that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world." A couple examples, just two that we're going to look at from the Old Testament, serve to show us the danger of pride and the consequences that come with it. The first one we're going to look at is in 2 Chronicles chapter 26. We meet an individual there by the name of Uzziah. He's also called Azariah. His father is named similarly. Amaziah, I believe the text tells us, yeah, in chapter 26, verse 1. This entire chapter is about this individual. We're told that he became king when he was 16 years of age, verses 1 through 3. Verse 3 says he was 16 when he became king. He reigned 52 years in Jerusalem. Tells us his mother's name was Jecoliah of Jerusalem. Verse 4 tells us that he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father Amaziah had done. The next several verses tell of his accomplishments. And then in verses 11 through 14, we're told how he had a huge, magnificent army. The text says he had an army of fighting men who went out to war by companies, verse 11, according to the number on their roll as prepared by Jael, the scribe, and Mesa, the officer under the hand of Hananiah, one of the king's captains. Total number of chief officers of the mighty men of valor was 2,600, and under their hand was an army of 307,500 that made war with mighty power to help the king against the enemy. Then Uzziah prepared for them, for the entire army, shields, spears, helmets, body armor, bows, and slings to cast stones. Verse 15 tells us that his fame spread far and wide, said he made devices in Jerusalem, invented by skillful men to be on the towers and the corners to shoot arrows and large stones. So his fame spread far and wide, for he was marvelously helped till he became strong. And then we see in verse 16 what happened as a result of that. When he was strong, his heart was lifted up to his destruction, for he transgressed against the Lord his God by entering the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. Verses 17 through 21 tell the consequences that he faced as a result of this. We're told that Azariah the priest went in after him, and with him were 80 priests of the Lord who were valiant men. They withstood King Uzziah and said to him, "It is not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Get out of the sanctuary, for you have trespassed. You shall have no honor from the Lord God." Then Uzziah became furious. He had a censer in his hand to burn incense. While he was angry with the priests, leprosy broke out on his forehead before the priests in the house of the Lord beside the incense altar. Azariah the chief priest and all the priests looked at him, and there on his forehead he was leprous. So they thrust him out of that place. Indeed, he also hurried to get out because the Lord had struck him. King Uzziah was a leper until the day of his death. He dwelt in an isolated house because he was a leper, for he was cut off from the house of the Lord. And we're told that his son was raised to reign in his place. Another perhaps more familiar account is that of King Nebuchadnezzar. This is found in the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 4. This is the occasion where Nebuchadnezzar has a dream about a great tree. Starting in verse 10, he calls his wise men before him. He tells them the dream. They cannot explain the dream, so he calls Daniel and he tells the dream to Daniel. Then Daniel gives his response. He says in verse 10, "I was looking, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth. Its height was great. The tree grew and became strong. Its height reached to the heavens. It could be seen to the ends of all the earth. Its leaves were lovely, its fruit abundant, and it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it. The birds of the heavens dwelt in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. I saw in the visions of my head while on my bed, and there was a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven. He cried aloud and said, 'Chop down the tree and cut off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts get out from under it and the birds from its branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze, and the tender grass of the field. Let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts on the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from that of a man. Let him be given the heart of an animal, and let seven times pass over him.'" And of course, Daniel reiterates the dream, giving it the interpretation that he is going to be this individual who's going to suffer the consequences stated in this dream. And Daniel warns him in verse 27. He says, "Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by being righteous, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps there may be a lengthening of your prosperity." However, we see Nebuchadnezzar's pride in the next few verses and the consequences that came as a result of it. Verse 28 beginning, "All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar at the end of the 12 months. He was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying, 'Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty?' While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven, 'King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, and the kingdom has departed from you. They shall drive you from men. Your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses.' That very hour the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws." And then we're told in verse 34, at the end of the time, he lifted up his eyes. He's speaking in the first person. "I lifted up my eyes and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, 'What have you done?' He has learned his lesson." He says in verse 36, "At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the kingdom of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride, he is able to abase or to make low." These accounts certainly call to mind Proverbs 16, verse 18, a well-known passage. "Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." Obviously, there are various forms of pride, various shades, if you will, of pride. People can be proud of being spiritual, For example, spiritual pride or haughtiness. In Mark chapter 12, we're told about the scribes. Jesus said, "Beware the scribes who desire to go around in long robes. They love greetings in the marketplaces, the best seats in the synagogues, and the best place at feasts." We're also very familiar with the pride of the Pharisees. Luke chapter 18 alluded to it this morning. We'll read the text this evening. Verse 10, we're told by Jesus in verse 9, in fact, that he spoke this parable to some who trusted themselves that they were righteous and they despised others. He said, "Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, 'God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess.' The tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, 'God, be merciful to me, a sinner.' Jesus said, 'I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other.'" And then he says in verse 14, the latter part, "Everyone who exalts himself will be abased, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." Well, how about us? Do we sometimes feel that we are more spiritual than others? As we look around, do we assess ourselves and walk away thinking that we are exceptional in some kind of way? Do we see ourselves as never in the wrong? It's always somebody else's fault. Too proud for mistakes, too proud to admit our faults, too proud to admit our shortcomings. Do we feel that others just aren't doing anything? The old, what we call the Elijah complex. It was said that a Puritan man said to his wife, I don't know why it couldn't have been the wife said to her husband, but nonetheless, it was a Puritan man who said to his wife, "There is none righteous but me and thee, and sometimes I wonder about thee." There are self-appointed policemen who seem to think it's their duty, their mission, to go around fixing and straightening everybody else out. We need to be cautious lest we find ourselves developing an attitude like that. So there's spiritual pride, there's intellectual pride. This is one I don't have to worry about. But thinking that you're above other people because of your intellectual prowess. You probably heard the story, and I'm sure it's told in a variety of ways, but about the preacher, the Boy Scout, and the rocket scientist. They're the only three passengers on this plane with a very, very small plane, and they're up flying around, and the pilot steps back, puts his head back, and says, "Guys, I got bad news, plane's going down." And what's worse, there are only three parachutes, four of us here, there are only three parachutes, and since I'm married and I've got a couple of kids, I'm an important guy, I'm a pilot, I'm taking one and I'm off. And so he grabs a parachute, whips it on, and jumps off the plane. And the rocket scientist jumps up and says, "I'm the smartest man in the world needs me," and he grabs another parachute and he jumps off the plane. Preacher sadly looks at the young Boy Scout and he says, "Son, I've lived a rich life, I've been very blessed, you're young and healthy, you go ahead and take the last parachute." And the little Boy Scout says, "Don't worry. The smartest guy in the world just grabbed my backpack and jumped off. We got two parachutes left." Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 1 that knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. There's materialistic pride as well. A happiness or a pride based on one's possessions. We recall how the rich fool put his trust, his happiness in his material things only to lose his life that very night. Luke chapter 12. John Foster once said, "The pride of dying rich raises the loudest laughter in hell." Ironically, some may be proud of their poverty. They despise the wealthy. They see the wealthy as being proud and boastful, yet they are proud that they are not proud and boastful like the wealthy. A man by the name of Norman Gibson once put it this way. He said, "Some people are proud of wearing new clothes and driving new cars. Not I. I'm proud of wearing old clothes and driving old cars, which only proves that I think my pride is better than yours, in my humble opinion." Socrates once told Diogenes, who lived in a tub and dressed in rags, he said, "I see your vanity through the holes in your cloak." Kind of reminds me of the story of the people regarding being so proud of being humble. There's a story called the Humility Club. This club of humble people, and every year they would give an award to the person that they deemed to have been most humble throughout that year. And if you came forward to accept the award, they would take it away from you. Think about that for a minute. Okay, you showed your lack of humility. Yeah, okay. So then there's social pride or disdain, pride in one's position. James chapter 2, James condemns Christians who made a distinction between visitors that they deemed worthy of their attention, the wealthy, and then they disregarded those who were obviously poor. We think of Diotrephes in 3 John, who loved to have the preeminence among men. Someone has well said that pride is the only disease known to man that makes everybody sick except the person who has it. Of course, there are many other shades or stripes of pride, but regardless of the specific motive behind them, God disdains pride in man. When we lived in New Jersey, there was a practice, January, February every year, that the Super Bowl, I'm not a fan of things like that. Is it the first Sunday in February or something? Yay, did well. Okay. And so every year at the Super Bowl, on Super Bowl Sunday, there was a family who opened their home, and everybody went over after services and watched the game or played games and did other things while the football game was on. And I remember this one. I think it was we hadn't been there a couple of years, and this was 1992. And you Super Bowl fans, probably some of you may know where I'm going with this, or you will in a moment. Dallas Cowboys were playing the Buffalo Bills, and the Dallas Cowboys were beating them terribly. And I think it was at the very end of the game, there was a player for the Dallas Cowboys. I later learned his name was Leon Lett. And he's coming toward the touchdown line. He's ready to make a touchdown. And he gets real cocky. And again, this is probably one of those major things in football history that everybody knows except me. But I did see it, and so he runs real fast, and he gets there, and right before he crosses the line, he starts doing his little dance, his little strut, and this other guy comes up from the other team and just slaps the ball out of his hands. And I learned later that this guy, I guess in team sports, had not made a touchdown since he was 10 years old. Sorry. The poor guy, but if that doesn't demonstrate pride and where it can get you, I fail to think of an example that would. In Matthew 16:24 and following, Jesus said, "If anyone would be my disciple, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." You know, it's impossible to carry pride and a cross at the same time. James said that God resists the proud in chapter 4, verse 6, but he shows favor to the humble. Just a few verses later, he said, "Humble yourself in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up." The prophet Micah said in chapter 6, verse 8, "What does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. May all of us seek to do just that. Let's stand together and sing the song that's been chosen.